So a few years ago, when I was much younger, like 24 years old, okay, I guess I mean a long time ago, not just a few years ago, the year was 1984. I don't know if anybody remembers that far back. Some of you probably do, but most of you probably don't. Probably the most media-worthy would point you to the book written by George Orwell in 1949, he wrote, and the name of the book was called 1984. Imagine that. In the book, the population is brainwashed and the government is controlled by an always listening and watching Big Brother. I don't know if you ever heard of that. That's what he was called. You ever heard of Big Brother? He's the one that's always watching and listening. But that was in the book, 1984. But what I remember was not the book, because I wasn't that much of a reader or that much interested in the school type things. So what I do remember from 1984 was, even though I was married and had probably several children, how many? Huh? Three. I had three kids by then. By 1984, I had to ask my wife, because I don't always remember the years. I remember 1981 and I think 89, but 87? 88? 88. I remember 88. So all of them are between there. So we had three kids at the time, 1984. But even though back then, when I only had three children, they only had three TV networks at the time, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Those were the three networks. You got three channels of TV in 1984, basically. Now you get like 200 or something on one plan, and then you can get another plan. But it's different than it was then. Even though we had those three TV networks, the content of the commercials on TV were much better than what they are now. Do you even know any of the commercials that are going on now? No? See? The ones from back then were much better, because you don't even know what they're doing now. Back then they were clever and funny and very believable. Yes, they were. And one of the companies had a very popular catchphrase commercial that the whole population embraced. And I have in a clip, that I have a clip of three commercials in a row that this is what we saw on TV in 1984. So let's take a look at that. Would you look at that? It's 1984 TV. Yeah. How do you like those? Oh my goodness. See how great they were? They're so believable, aren't they? And they were very effective commercials. They're still in business. Have you ever heard of Wendy's? Yeah, 1984. Those were the commercials that kept them going. Well, the first time that I heard that, well, not the first time that I heard that, but when I first played it just a couple days ago, or yesterday, I could not stop laughing when I heard the commercial after all these years even. I still laugh when I hear it. And did you get the catchphrase? I hear a "where's the beef" every once in a while. It's "where's the beef?" So nowadays they just don't make TV like they used to. The commercials are much worse than what they used to be. So today's title, or the message of today's title, took me back to those commercials. And what's the title? "Where's My Joy?" But actually it was just "Where's My Joy?" But when I read "Where's My Joy?", it made me think of those "Where's the Beef?" commercials. So I kind of must have been stuck in my head or something. Can you say it with me? "Where's my joy?" Yeah. I demand my joy. Where is it? So we live in a time of, or when it's easy to get caught up in social media and politics, and it's easy to get pushed into taking sides on issues and people tugging on our emotions to pull us in. Isn't it easy? With all the Facebook stuff and all the stuff that goes on, people trying to get you to take a side. And there are so many crazy topics now that are kind of new, that they didn't used to be in 1984 anyway. I mean, I would need a scoreboard to, not only a scoreboard, a dictionary to try to keep up with the gender crisis that we're in right now. I would not only need a scoreboard, but I would also need a dictionary, because half of the words I've never even heard of. But somehow they come up with them. But there's a gender crisis going on. I don't know if you know that or not, but there is. And now so many things are racist. Did you know that it doesn't even have to be about race to be racist now? It doesn't even have to even deal with race, and still it's racist. So a lot of things goes on that are confusing, and media sometimes inflates what's going on and what people are saying, and people jump on bandwagons that didn't used to exist, but now they do. So there are some things that are not new, but still seem to surge into what our thinking should be. Something might replace what we should be thinking because of all that pressure we get from the outside. According to media and some scholars, there are things that are feeding our minds now. And there are some things that are feeding our minds. I have an example of one in my notes that we'll be covering in a little bit. But I think that these tactics are used by Satan, which we talked a little bit in class about Satan, and in the few sermons ago we talked about him. In fact, we had the one where we had the road that Satan was trying to knock us off the road. Well, I think that's all the same subject. There are some tactics used by Satan to block our view and knock us off that narrow path in our, what should be, our Christian walk. So when we're trying to do a Christian walk, there are some things that Satan throws out there that I believe this is true. He puts out there to distract us and try to get us off that path. You might remember that from that skit I just mentioned just a few weeks ago that had the few kids in there and Floyd. And we had the whistleblowers on the side. If we got off the path, a whistleblower, which we never talked about those whistleblowers. Those are probably the rest of the church, that when somebody blows the whistle, that's the church warning you to get back on the path. But we didn't cover that in the skit. But that's the skit we had. If you recall, during that skit, I used Ephesians 6:12 to show that there are actually spiritual battles going on, whether or not we are aware of it. There are spiritual battles going on with Satan, with God, with us, with our minds. Whether we're aware of it or not, they're going on. So we need to be careful about who and what we believe or believe in. And that's one thing I like about our church. We always encourage self-study and have a yearning to understand what God wants us to know. Of all the churches and the churches of God, that's pretty much a standard thing. People want to know what's going on, and people want to know what the truth is. So the monologue skits we had earlier were for this message as a lesson. You might wonder why they were in there and I didn't say anything about them. Well, they were prepared or done for this message. I feel they represent the teaching of many people or they represent the feeling of many people in their rut of life. A lot of people get into a rut in life. You had the young girl who was in a rut, in her own rut, and you have the mom who is in her own rut. Maybe all of us feel like this at some level or at one time in our life. That's how we feel. We feel like we're stuck in a rut. We can't really get out of it. So where's my joy? You could you anybody find joy in the young girl's conversation? Do you remember it? It didn't sound like it. I'm sure that she wanted joy, but all she saw was misery. And I changed my notes. When I first put it down, I didn't put saw. All she had was misery, or all she said was misery, but all she saw was memory or misery. It's what she saw. She is so mistreated. You heard her. She had to go to Hawaii for vacation and lay on the beach with her hairy dad next to her so that none of the boys would look at her because of her hairy dad. I thought that was kind of funny in the skit. But she saw the hairy dad. She didn't see she got to go to Hawaii. She saw the hairy dad. So such misery and so mistreated. And not selfish. I got that one wrong. She was very selfish. You could hear everything she said was about her and why she didn't get this and why she didn't get that. And all she didn't say was, where's my joy? She didn't say that, but she might as well have, right? She deserves it. That joy is hers. She should be able to take it. It's no wonder people get this way, since we are taught to be like this. And I'm going to share with you an excerpt or some excerpts. How do you say that? Excerpts? From an article that I read. It came from MSNBC, 2018 it was written. And I want to share this part or part of this article with you to make some of the message's point, and just by what the article says. And if you can't see that some of this, you might be able to hear what I'm saying in this article and you might agree 100% with it, and that's fine if you do. And if you do, then I want you to school me after this message sometime this morning. You can tell me why it is you think that it is true. And Jennifer and I went over it a little bit, and we didn't exactly agree on everything about it, but that's fine. So this is part of the article, and here's the name of the article: Why Putting Yourself First Improves Your Happiness and Productivity. And there's a quote under the picture. There's a girl here on a lawn chair. There's a quote under the picture: when your needs are met and you feel good about yourself, it's easier to elevate the needs of other people in front of your own, which is a pretty good statement. It's written by Liz Bentley, like I said, in 2018. And here's, I couldn't do all of it, so I'm just going to do some of it. So recently, I'm reading the article now. Recently, I was at a cocktail party talking to a friend who, like me, is a mother of three children. The conversation progressed into an interesting debate. Is motherhood comprised of 100 selfish or 100 selfish, selfless acts in a day? By way of example, my friend explained that she gets up early every day to make her children a healthy breakfast, which she considers a selfless act. She would rather be sleeping in. I retorted that it was selfish because she loved her children and she values their health and time she spends with them. Either way, it's the same act viewed in two different mindsets. In coaching, I frequently hear the word selfish tossed about, often with a negative connotation. Someone feels badly that they were being selfish, or someone else was selfish and it was offensive. Selfishness is the lack of considering others when only being concerned with your own personal advantage. That's supposed to be the definition of selfish. It can be a great weakness. Clearly, the ability to put others' needs in front of your own is an important life skill in which we need to be able to do without resentment, even when it's completely inconvenient and has a sacrifice. However, I would argue that the motivation behind that decision should be self-serving. In most cases, being selfish is just a matter of perspective. It's critical to happiness and self-evolution. Let me explain. First, let's talk about why it's important to be selfish. Author Brené Brown has discovered in her research on wholehearted living, loving yourself more than you love others is the first and most critical step in seeking happiness and fulfillment. In fact, she says it's impossible to love anyone more than you love yourself. Taking care of yourself is the pathway to fulfillment and to high performance in work and life. And then that's all the article proper I was going to read, but there were some like addendums afterwards that showed different. I'll just read what it says. Some of the derailments to prevent your happiness that she talked about were giving too much, and there was a section on giving too much. It was all defined. And then giving too much is some of the reason why you derail your happiness. And some of it is taking too much time for yourselves or ourselves. And some of it was fearing failure. That was a derailment to your happiness. And the last one was not playing enough. That would prevent your happiness. So that is some teaching that goes on. That was in an article from, like I said, MSNBC. It was just online, an online article. I don't know if it was in a paper or not. I think it was printed from a paper, a newspaper, or a TV thing converted to print. So, where's my joy? Liz Bentley says, it's in your selfishness. That's what I just read that article. If that's the case, then the character that Natalie played should have been flooded with joy because she was plenty selfish, right? But it didn't sound like she was. What does the Bible say about this? And we'll go to slide one. It should be James 3:13 through 16. Do I want to read them from my Bible or do I want to read them from behind me? I don't like to read behind me. James 3:13 through 16. Hebrews James, right? James 3:13 through 16. I usually mark these, but I didn't today. It says, who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in his gentle wisdom, or in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have been bitter, jealous, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant so to lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes from above, but it is earthly, natural, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So I'm thinking that James is teaching us that selfishness and jealousy bring chaos and evil. It's not something that brings us joy. It's something that brings, selfishness brings chaos and evil. That's what the verse is telling us in James 3. Another verse is Romans 8, verse 5. That's one I'll read because there's only one. For those who are in accord with the flesh set their minds of the things of the flesh, and those who are in accord with the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. It's like there are only two different things, the flesh and the Spirit. And that's really what I think. And I'll paraphrase this verse like this. This is what I think this verse means. The people who think only of themselves are only concerned about what they can get for themselves. And those who include God in their lives, they do the things that please Him. So that's what I think that verse means. A little bit different than what it says, isn't it? But that's my paraphrase of Romans 8, verse 5. What about the other character in our skit? Isn't that one much more relatable? I mean, nobody's really like what Natalie was, are they? That just sit there and yak on the phone all the time and everything is bad and terrible and did you hear what Bobby said and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't really go on, does it? Doesn't it seem more reasonable like the typical mom, the other character? I kind of think it does. And it's so easy to get caught up in that humdrum of life and be consumed by it. There's laundry, there's breakfast, there's programs, there's sports. And then you have more kids, so there's more sports. And then there's another kid, so you have more sports. And all these things take up all your time. And it consumes you. Does Satan work with this? I think so. He works with partial truths and confusion. So when I was reading this article that was written, that Liz wrote, there are some things in there that are true, but there are also some things in there that are kind of not so true. So they're mixed together to confuse us. So he works with partial truths and confusion, just like he did in the beginning with Eve. You remember that story. Satan spoke to Eve. There was some truth and there was some not so truth in there, but it was put together so that it kind of confusing. So this character that was played by Sarah reminds me of the church at Laodicea, which you probably have heard of from Revelation 3. The church of Laodicea is in Revelation 3. And it turns out that that was the church that was called lukewarm. The character intended to do a better job with her spiritual life. She read her Bible, but she was still caught up in all of her things. She read her Bible. She wanted a better spirituality, but she was drowned in stuff. She didn't have time for it, but she wanted it. She said she wanted it, but she didn't have time for it. How close is that to describing us? There are a couple of famous quotes that are about good intentions. One of them is, good intentions are just that. Meaning, you want to do something, but you never do it. Anybody do that? Am I the only one? I want to do something, but I just never do it. That's a good intent. That's good intentions are just that. Here's another one that's very similar. The real one is similar to what I'm going to read about good intentions. The road to destruction is paved with good intentions. The meaning? I intend to have a good spiritual life and please God, but I always put off doing it. It doesn't happen for my whole life, and then it's too late. That's what I think that one means. The road to destruction is paved with good intentions. I mean to do it, 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 and finally I get too old and die. Because it's something that you have to do. You have to get ahead of what you want to do and go ahead and do it. Remember from the few weeks ago, we had the two paths. We had the narrow path and the wide path. The wide path to destruction and that narrow one that leads to life. There are only two. Here's a quote that was brought to my attention this week. It has a little bit to do with it. Sometimes you have to let go of the picture of what you thought your life would be like and learn to find the joy in the story that you're actually living. So we have dreams about what things should be. And we always are looking out to what things are going to be, but we have to be satisfied and find joy in what we're in. The second character, Sarah's character, isn't finding any joy either, is she? Did you see joy in her story? Remember, this is about joy. How can we find joy? Where's my joy? I think to find true joy like the Bible talks about, we must understand our place. Even though true joy comes from within us, and I don't disagree, there was another character that was in this little skit that we didn't do, but the point of the skit was that joy comes from within, and I think that's true, that joy does come from us. But it isn't from our selfishness. But it is from our relationship with God in His Christ. It doesn't come from our selfishness. It comes from what our relationship with God and His Christ are. Joy is part of fruit of the Spirit, as mentioned in Galatians 5. You know the fruit of the Spirit, and it starts out by saying the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and goes on and on. And there are nine pieces of fruit of the Spirit that are mentioned. Joy is the second one mentioned. And fruit is an outcome, not the action. So joy isn't something that we go and do. It's a fruit or the outcome, not the action. Fruit is the result. It comes from the growth. When you plant a tree for fruit, it has to grow before it can make fruit. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And it was, yeah, she knows. And it's why I believe the allegory is written in the form that it is. So joy is a result of our spiritual growth, along with the other fruit. Not only joy, but love, peace, patience, kindness, all those things that you gotta plant in, not dig out, that was in that song. So those other fruits are part of the growth as well. So if we're having a problem with joy or a lack of joy in our lives, maybe we should examine our spiritual growth. Doesn't that make sense? If fruit is a result of the growth, let's look at our growth. Maybe our growth is not really what it should be. So easy, right? So easy to do. Well, that's what the church is all about. Helping each other do just that. If we're having trouble, that's what brothers and sisters are for, to lean on and help us to find our way a little bit easier than trying to find it only on our own. I believe that the joy of the Bible teaches that joy does not come from selfishness, but rather from humility. If I say it's not from selfishness, then what is it from? It's from humility. I think that selfish and humble, or meek, another word for humble, are exact opposites. So if they are, then one would be right and one wouldn't be right, right? If they're completely opposites and one person says that your joy comes from selfishness and another person says, no, it comes from humility. So we have to decide what is it really from. We should look into it and find out what we think is right. But I think that selfishness and humble are exact opposites. Selfish is you think that you are more important. That's what you think. Humble or meek is you think that you are less important. So they are opposite, aren't they? One's more important, one's less important. Remember the joy that we started with in December. We used the J-O-Y, Jesus, Others, Yourself. It had the three segments. And I know that people might get confused if I confuse God in the place of Jesus and say, oh, well, that's not really what the example is. But I'm going to say that God or Jesus is number one. That's your J and the joy. The others, the O, is second, and yourself is last. That's what humility is. That's the picture of humility. Yourself is last, not first. So I want to share a Bible text to think about. It came because of this. Is anybody doing this? Read the Bible in a year? This one is the Love, Seek, Grow, or Love, Grow, Seek. Seek, Grow, Love. I know I get it right if I read it. You can see I have some crossed off. That means I've started. Am I caught up? No. But I will before it's December 31st. I'll catch up and stop and catch up and stop. But I'll get through it, and I'll read the Bible in a year because I'm going to follow this program. And I think it's a good thing to do. So I listen to it in my truck because I have the Bible downloaded on my phone. And Micah one time showed me how to get it on the radio from my phone, and it didn't stay. So Nathan from Oregon showed me like a week ago, and now I can remember how to get it on my radio from my phone. So if you want to know how to do that, ask Nathan. So I do that when I'm driving, and while I was listening to the Bible in my truck the other day, I heard the story of Jacob. That was what we were covering. I was in Genesis still. I heard the story of Jacob. Do you ever think of Jacob and the story of Jacob as a man that was a man of great humility? I never did until I listened to it this time in my truck. It's funny how you can hear the same thing over and over, and pretty soon you sink in something new. Well, I got humility from the story that I was listening to the other day. And I forgot how fascinating it is, and Floyd does remember how fascinating it is, that story of Jacob between Genesis 26 and 31. How much stuff Jacob did and how he got his 13 children. It was a regular soap opera. That story is like a soap opera. It would make a great movie. He was so in love with Rachel. You should read it. You can see that everywhere in the story, how much he was in love with Rachel. Before that, before he got his 13 children, he was instructed to run away to his uncle Laban's house to find a wife. His mother sent him away because his brother was going to kill him. Or she thought he was going to kill him. Esau, his brother, was going to kill Jacob because he got the blessing that Esau thought he should have had. So he did. He went to his brother's Laban. He went there alone. He went there with nothing but his cloak and his staff, is what it says. But when he left with 13 kids and a lot more than that. God told Jacob in a dream to go back to the place of his birth after he had acquired his wives and had his children. God told him in a dream, go back to your place of your birth. And he agreed. It's not that he agreed, he obeyed what God's instruction was, but at the same time, he's going back to the place where Esau was. So I'm sure there was huge fear. And the verses say that there was huge fear that when he got back that Esau would kill him, and he was afraid of that. So there were a few verses that are tucked away in this text that hooked my attention. God told him to go back where he thought Esau, his brother, would kill him. In Genesis 32, 9 through 12, this is a prayer that Jacob says right before he goes back to face Esau. Jacob said, "The God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, Lord," or he's beginning a prayer, "who said to me, 'Return to your company and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am worthy of all the favor of the faithfulness. I am unworthy of all the favor and of all the faithfulness which you have shown your servant. For only my staff and I crossed the Jordan River, and now I have become two companies. Please save me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will assuredly make you prosper and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be counted." So this is Jacob's prayer back when he was on his way back. And what caught me was verse 10. Even though he has this great companies and great wealth, he considers himself unworthy of all the favors and the faithfulness that God had given him. He's showing true humility there. He's going and saying that he doesn't deserve it, and telling God that he understands, "I don't deserve this, but you've even given me this." And I kind of think that this is like a PS thing down here. "For you told me that I'm going to be great in descendants like the sand that's on the seashore. So don't let Esau kill me, because how can that happen if that goes on? If Esau kills all of my children and me, then that can't happen." So I think he may be putting God on the spot a little bit here, saying, "This is the promise you gave to me. Remember it. Here I go to face Esau." But he showed his humility in the fact that he was unworthy for all the things that God gave him. And that kind of hooked my mind a little bit. And later on in Genesis 33, 1 through 4, they meet. He sends messengers ahead The messengers come back and say, yeah, Esau's coming and he's got 400 men with him. So I bet you that made him feel great. No, it didn't. It scared the pants off of him. I don't think they wore pants. They just had cloaks. I don't know. But it scared him. But when they did finally meet, Jacob raised his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided his children into the groups. Verse 2, he put the slave woman and the children in the front, and Leah and her children next, then Rachel and Joseph last. He saved Rachel for last in case something bad was going to happen. That's part of the reason that shows that how much he loved Rachel. He saved her for last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. So all turned out well. He did have joy, but he put his humility into play before that happened. When we know that all we have is from God, and we know that we don't deserve it, we will find joy in all that we have. Not from our selfishness, but knowing that God has given us everything that we have. Philippians 2, 3 and 4 says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility consider one another as more important than yourselves. There's some instructions from the Bible that we should be listening to. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. This is a little bit to do with the last days, showing that, you know, some of this attitude and teaching may be related to signs of the times. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, slanderers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy. That's what that first girl was, ungrateful. I don't have anything. My parents make things miserable. Unloving, verse 3. Irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. We have to put God first. God, others, yourself. That's the order. It's a sign of the times. For our closing verse, let's go to James 3, 17 and 18. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peace-loving, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial, free of hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So let's close with song number 1, How Great Thou Art. Do you know that song? How great is God? God is so big. We did that one earlier, but this one is How Great Thou Art. Let's stand as we sing.